Here we go, our In the Garage podcast for this week. Adam Carolla, our guest, we're going to get to him in just a second. We're talking about Le Mans. It's the 50th anniversary of Ford's victory there. And, of course, one of the big stories in auto racing this year was the return of the Ford GT, and they just covered everybody to win there. But in 1966, it was a different story. They had kind of blown it in 1965. Ford had changed the engines in the last possible second and wound up having failures, and they were trying to beat Ferrari. There's so many layers to this story, the battle between Ford and Ferrari and really what it was all about. Adam has a documentary. It's at chassis.com. It's called The 24-Hour War, Ford versus Ferrari. It's a wonderful piece. If there's one book about it you want to read, it's Go Like Hell. If it's a documentary you want to watch about it, it's this one. So here you go. Had a chance to catch up with Adam Carolla, the producer and director behind The 24-Hour War, Ford versus Ferrari at Le Mans. So 24-Hour War. Now, I had read the book Go Like Hell and became friends with AJ Bame and really started diving into it, especially being here in Detroit. And when I heard that you were doing this, the documentary, I'm like, okay, I want to see how this goes. You guys really did a great job. And it to me, as much as the footage, Adam, it's the interviews. You really pulled a lot out of people that I didn't know about this.
Well, thanks. And it's always a compliment, you know, coming from someone who knows a lot about it to find out that they learn even more about it. So, you know, that's kind of our job. You know, I it's the way I look at it. You know, I look at it as for people who never heard the story, they should be entertained by it. You know, some of the wives and whatnot. And for the aficionados, they should learn something about it. And I should learn something about it, too, because, you know, there's so many people, there's so many moving parts, there's so many stories. It's just impossible to know all of it. And when you do the movie, you get to sit down with guys like Dan Gurney and hear it firsthand.
And then, you know, like some of the footage you had, too, of Carroll Shelby and his shop. I mean, it wasn't just Carroll. That whole crew in California, they were badasses. Those were like the coolest guys on the block, weren't they?
Yeah, and it's crazy how young they were, you know, 19, 20-year-olds, you know. You think about now, every 19-year-old, within the sound of my voice, is cowering in some safe space. These guys were out racing and building and welding and bending aluminum, you know, and shaping it with a buck, you know, and using a English wheel. Like, these guys were... You know, it's incredible when you interview guys like Pete Brock, just to see like how relatively young they are.
Yeah, you know? That's what I was taken back to. I'm like, when did they tape this? 20 years ago? I'm like, no, this is him now.
Yeah, so he couldn't. You know, he was in his 20s, his early 20s. You know, all these guys were so young that they don't seem old enough to be in that era, or you know. Not in the era, but like, you know, to be players in that era, you know.
And you look at too at the, I mean, the storyline leading up to this, you know, the first win for Ford in 66, but everybody, you know, this what happened in 65 to me, and I'm glad you touched on it, was just as dramatic how they were supposed to win in 65 with this Ford GT, and it was a transmission part they changed at the last minute, wasn't it?
They changed all the engines.
That's right. Yeah.
And I guess they didn't stress them or dyno them or something because the head bolts all stretched, and that was the problem. And I don't know if it was like a case of just having too much money or Ford just wanted a Ford-built engine in there and maybe not Holman Moody or whoever was building the engines, but I don't know. But according to everybody, they just swapped out the engines the night before for new motors, and the new motors evidently weren't broken in right because the head bolt stretched.
Do you think in 66 when they crossed 1-2-3 and Ken Miles got screwed? That's one of the biggest jam jobs I've ever seen. I mean, the guy was the best driver. You know, they had won Daytona, they'd won Sebring, and they had everybody covered. They were up by laps in that, weren't they? I mean, at one point. They had everybody by Ken, two or three laps.
Ken Miles was.
Okay,
yes.
So Ken Miles gets to the end of this, and they tell him, for folks who haven't seen this, and I don't want to give everything away in the story, but, you know, they made him line up 1-2-3 so they could have the photo op. There's no way in my mind.
They made him finish that way. Yeah.
Right. There's no way in my mind that Ford didn't know the rules. I find that hard to believe. Here's just talking about how exact they were, that they wanted a Ford motor in the car, and you know, the stories about the making the glass flown in, what they took an entire first class of an airplane and brought the stuff over. They had so many people assigned to this project. They knew the rules.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that we'll ever have a clear answer on that, or I don't know if anyone will want to admit it, or I don't know if that's just something that Ford took to his grave. But, you know, I think when it comes to Henry Ford II, he wants bragging rights. So he wants a 1-2-3 photograph of three Ford GT40s all just crossing the finish line door to door as basically a show of dominance to Ferrari in the world, you know. So that's what he wants. Now, Ken Miles is, you know, multiple laps in the lead, and I don't think that Ford cares. Like, I don't think he cares if Ken Miles wins this thing, or Dan Gurney wins this thing, or Bruce McLaren wins this thing. Like, I don't think it makes a difference to him. As long as they're driving a Ford and he's got his picture, then it's fine. So I don't believe, like, I would go halfway with y'all on it, which is I don't believe he even checked. I think he just said, as long as there's three Ford GT40s coming across the finish line simultaneously, it'll be 1-2-3. I don't care what the order is or who the driver is. We'll have our photograph. That's probably what he did.
And that's kind of the culture, too, that you touch on in the documentary, Adam. Is, I mean, even on the other side with Ferrari, with Enzo, they were never close to the drivers. I mean, you think about what Ascari and Bandini and Wolfgang von Trips and all the people who died driving for Ferrari. I'm sure there was a point where Enzo's like, I don't want to know these guys anymore because the odds are they're going to die.
Yeah, Ferrari told his son Piero, like, don't make friends with these guys because they're going to die. So, you know, you don't want to be heartbroken when your friend catches on fire, you know, next season. So I think that's, yeah, there was a lot of, there's a lot of that back then. And, you know, the drivers weren't really the stars. The cars were the stars, I think, or the brand was in their mind. And there's a lot of nationalism as well. You know, Surtees was taken out of the Ferrari, even though he was the fastest,
right?
Because they wanted an Italian driver in there, you know, so stuff like that, you know, it was a very, you know, old school stuff back then. You know, it wasn't today's world that we're so used to, that's so politically correct, or, you know, there's a crumple zone and an airbag everywhere, or a restrictor plate, or whatever it is.
Right.
They just didn't have any of that back then. It's just, it was sort of Wild West, but international Wild West.
Well, and you touch on it too. You guys touch on the idea of a Ford GT. I mean, this is a brand new car. This isn't a derivative of anything. I mean, this was a completely new design from the ground up, and they had no time to do it. You think about it, you got to be Looney Tunes to commit to doing it. And then if you're a driver, you got to have a pretty big set of balls to get behind the wheel of a car that does 220, 230, and no idea what the hell's going to happen when you get to the end of the Mulsanne Straight the first time.
Yeah, well, that's what these guys had. They had big huevos, and that was part of the deal, you know, and that came with the territory. And they, I don't think they, I'm walking my dog, by the way.
Oh, no worries. That's all right.
Hear the sound of cars in the background. It was part of being a race driver. It was, you know, part skill and then part daring and thrill seeking. You know, that's why these guys were heroes, because they were like war heroes, you know, because the reason war heroes are looked at in a little different vein than baseball heroes is in one endeavor, you risked your life, you know. They were like war heroes in that they risked their lives when they got into the car, statistically, for sure. So I think that's why these guys would, you know, I think that was part of it for them.
Just that whole,
sure they were, yeah, they were adrenaline junkies too, you know, whereas I think guys today, you know, they grow up, they start in carts, go-karts, they go to, you know, quarter, half midgets or quarter midgets or whatever they're driving, and it becomes a skill set, you know, and even though they enjoy it and they get a thrill out of it, they're not daredevils, you know. These guys were daredevils.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not a knock on Jimmy Johnson or a Lewis Hamilton or Nico Rosberg or any of the Indy guys, but you look at a guy like Ken Miles, here's a guy who was a tank commander. I mean, you know, and drove right. Everything. Like, I mean, you think about what killed him was that J car. I mean, the idea that he's like, yeah, sure. How fast do you want to go? I'll do it. He was doing what, 170 when he lost that car?
I don't know that anyone knows, like, the exact speed, because I didn't really have any telemetry stuff back then. But to hear the guys who were there kind of speak of it, yeah, 170 or 180, and a honeycomb, you know, experimental car that, you know, again, it's called test driving. You know, it was testing because it was an experiment, you know, and then experiments go wrong. And you hope it happens at 30 miles an hour, not at 180. But in Ken's case, it happened at 180.
And then not having, in you know, strange way, Adam, not having that roll cage in the car, which, you know, when Ken was ejected, and making them put a roll cage in it afterwards is probably what saved Mario Andretti's life at Le Mans the next year.
Yeah, because he got in a pretty bad accident himself.
How do you forget? How do you not put the brakes on the right way, if that's true about the brake pads? How do you put them on backwards? That's kind of tough to do, isn't it?
I think sleep deprivation.
Yeah, it's true. It was like, what, 3 in the morning or something?
Probably. People make a lot of bad decisions, so, you know, just like long-haul truckers do when they don't get enough sleep, you know?
But you driving, Adam, I mean, you've obviously been on the track and your passion for it. I don't know that I've ever had an experience like that where I've had, you know, my 74 Vega locked up once doing 30. That doesn't count. But going 150 miles an hour and you hit the brakes like Andretti did at Le Mans and the car just starts spinning like a top.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that guys like Andretti are around today, and so generous, by the way. You know, he was very willing to give a lot of his time with the Newman documentary and now with the 24-Hour War as well. It's just great to get these legends. Not only are they around, but willing to sit down and really, you know, in the movie, oh, when you add it all up, there may be 8 minutes of Mario Andretti, but believe me, you interview him for 2 hours.
So, and the other thing too, that you guys, I mean, for you to get access to Piero Ferrari and then the marketing director, I can never remember his name, the Ferrari, I want to have a glass of, I want to drink with him because that seems like the coolest freaking guy I've ever seen in my life. He seemed like the ultimate Ferrari guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just getting into Ferrari and bringing our cameras into places where they really don't allow cameras and sitting down with guys who never sit down for interviews, that was a real blessing. And, you know, part of why the product is so good, but also why it was expensive and time-consuming and difficult to make as well.
What's the vibe like as an American crew when you walk into Ferrari to talk about a period in their racing history where they got their head handed to them for 4 years?
Well, you know, what you do is you touch on that, and you also touch on a lot of the history and a lot of the winning and a lot of the, you know, no one pulls up in a, you know, Ken Lingenfelder doesn't pull up in a new Ferrari and you go, oh, sorry, I guess you couldn't get anything from Dodge. Like, Ferrari's got a plenty to be proud of.
Yeah, they do.
And they did back then and they do today. So, you know, it's not all about losing at Le Mans. A lot of it's about winning at Le Mans. You know?
Sure.
In order to dethrone the king, you got to be the king.
And that's, you did a great job. I keep saying this, Adam, but it really is. I love the interviews. I love the file footage you got. There's some stuff that you had of the crashes that I'd never seen before. And you know, the stuff of Carol and the rest of them. And here in Detroit, again, we know the stories about the Ford family, but we didn't realize, you know, the pressure, the immense pressure on these engineers to build this Ford GT. I mean, it was, I keep saying Looney Tunes, it really was.
Yeah. And, you know, there wasn't, you know, you couldn't sue for wrongful termination back then, you know. You either got the job done or you got S-canned, and that was about it. And because of that environment, it created one of the most iconic cars ever.
Do you think that's part of, like, even the rebirth that we're seeing now, the new Ford GT, and, you know, you look around all the manufacturers, the mid-engine Corvette that we're going to get, and, you know, the Viper out of FCA, and, you know, we hear talk about a Barracuda now, and all these horsepower wars that are going on. It's all inspired by that period, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all inspired by everything that came before it, and so a lot of it was magical, and then a lot of it got really bad, you know, as well. And I do think, you know, I think automotive racing is really no different than, you know, the heavyweight division. You know, there's some really great moments, and then there's some really bad decades.
Oh, blushed for just a second.
Yeah, I was just walking through my door.
That's okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was saying, you know, you take a look at the heavyweight division and you go, oh, man, Muhammad Ali and Chuck Frazier, Ken Norton, and George Foreman, what an incredible decade, you know, the 70s were. And then you get to the 80s, and you're like Ronaldo, Nehemiah. And,
yeah, it was pretty bad. Trevor Burbick for a while. Yeah.
Trevor Burbick and the Sphinx Brothers, like, huh?
Yeah.
So now you're like, oh, well, that was a bad decade. Ooh, Mike Tyson, and he's going to duke it out with Holyfield. So, okay, now we're back, you know. So it's not – they're ebbs and flows, you know, is the way I look at it. And this was just part of the best, you know, decade in racing, just –
yeah, and you can romanticize this story because it's such a cool story. So, Adam, I don't want to keep you. I know you got so much going on, and I'm looking forward to a totally unrelated to this. By the way, chassis.com is where you go to get this as well, the 24-hour war, Ford versus Ferrari at Le Mans.
Well, thanks.
There you go. Thank you, Adam.